Okay, could you introduce yourself? Let me make sure that you're sounding good. First of all, yeah, introduce yourself.
I'm Dr. Maria Mondragon Valdez, a multi-generation resident of the San Luis Valley, and a my ancestors previously came from the Taos Valley of northern New Mexico. Right there. Do you want me to try it again?
No, that it sounded okay. I just want to make sure that things are
okay. If not, I can reintroduce myself.
Yeah. No, I think it was okay because I can just raise that up a little bit.
Okay.
So I just wanted to hear.
Should I say I'm a graduate of North of?
Yeah, sure.
My name is Maria Mondragon Valdez. I'm a multi-generation resident of the San Luis Valley, and my ancestors were from the Taos Valley in northern New Mexico. I just received my PhD from the University of New Mexico in American Studies. My dissertation was on the Santa de Cristo land grant, and my focus was domination and resistance in land loss on the Santa de Cristo land grant.
Could you start out talking about the land and water?
Because I'm familiar with the Upper Rio Grande bioregion, which is commonly known as the Rio Rebar or the Upper River, I'd like to focus on this area. And the Rio Rebar is a broad geographic area with common microclimates, soils, biomes, and similar politics, social structure, and culture. The bioregion encompasses the contemporary counties in northern New Mexico, Taos, Rio Rebar, Sandoval, Mora, San Miguel in New Mexico, and Costilla and Conejos County in Colorado's San Luis Valley. In this context, the Rio Rebar bioregion is defined by the Rio Grande and not by the geopolitical lines that separated the southern part of the San Luis Valley from northern New Mexico. While the core settlements of the Rio Rebar were established in the 16th century, I'm most interested in the 19th century because this period set the stage for American annexation. By 1800s, the extended families living on the periphery of the older, well-established colonies were subsisting on beans, corn, squash, onions, and wheat. Villages at the lower elevations were able to grow chili, and there were orchards here in the upper reaches of the Rio Rebar in the San Luis Valley. We can't grow crops like chili, and our orchards are very minimal, just apples and maybe some plums, but not much. Self-reliance during the Mexican period and the Mexican period extended from 1821 to 1846 were premised on Spanish land use tenure practices. And in the context of New Mexico, the Spanish period extended from 1598 to 1821. Spanish settlement patterns were responsible for the layout of villages, plazas, and corridor farmsteads that are still visible to this day. Of the several customs transferred from Spain to the New World, the most important to agropastoral activities were the long lots and the communal upland lowland pastures. To farm in the frontier villages were allowed allocated varas, also called extensiones or long lots, divided into parallel ribbon-like strips at right angles to the streams. Varas were ideal for arid climates like New Mexico. Varas were long and narrow lots which commenced at the river's edge and extended from the river to the bottoms, marsh-like bottoms, to the pasture lands, to the woodlands, all the way to the foothills. Communal upland lowlands, or ejido common land, was a universal pattern that was been used around the world. Anthropologists call this transhumance. The transhumance land use pattern involves driving domestic animals like sheep from the lowlands to the upland pastures to graze during the summer. During the Spanish-Mexican period, ejido commons were enshrined in every village and set aside in all land grants. And in the context of the San Luis Valley, if we wouldn't have had this upland-lowland pattern, we would have never been able to subsist in this hostile climate, and mainly because we're at an elevation, the lowest elevation in the San Luis Valley, which is the headwaters of the Rio Rebar, is 7,500, and it goes up higher from there. In addition to the land tenure practices, settlement patterns, and organic spatial configurations like plazas, plazuelas, village clusters, and the farm of the corridor of farmsteads called La Corrieras were of paramount importance to the frontier settlements in New Mexico, but especially into the Rio Riba. Before the occupation, there were seven times more sheep than there were cattle in Mexico, according to historian David Weber. Sheep were the dietary staple. Their tallow was used for candles, and the wool was processed and woven for clothing and blankets. Along with sheep, there were some cows, but the sheep were they're problematic because they're really difficult and hard on the soil because of the way their hoofs compact the soil.
The sheep.
Okay. The sheep are problematic because of, their hoofs and, but in this time period, they did some rotating, but the big problem is because of raiding. All of the pasture areas were starting to get impacted because people couldn't move out of these little core settlements or the peripheral settlements. A historian I like that talks about problems with a sheep and what happens with sheep in confined areas is Robert McCameron, and he noted that environmental change was slow in the Rio Riba because population growth was lethargic and material progress was impeded by distance, topography, and remoteness. New Mexico could never be compared with colonial areas in the American South because our colonies were not distinguished by specialization in production and labor, nor by the export or import of products to and from similar specialized producers. But basically, in New Mexico, even though they did have a lot of sheep, very few profited, and the agropastoral pursuits were a means of self-reliance, and bartering was the norm, and bartering was commonly called cambalache. And the custom of trading of produce, services, and goods was widespread because of everybody was on a subsistence, kind of hand-to-mouth level. And this area was definitely, David Weber calls it the periphery of the periphery. We were an upland frontier in an area that was that colonialism was resisted and expansion was resisted into the even 1860s. So even though life was not perfect and idyllic, it was at a subsistence level compared to the areas in the American South. The post-Guadalupe Hidalgo changes are definitely distinct, and they happened fairly rapidly. At American occupation, the entire population of New Mexico lived on less than 1% of the land base. So people were definitely entrenched in their little, either in the kind of the old colonial core or on these little peripheral areas. And so by necessity, they had to move out. The population had exceeded the carrying capacity of the land, and everything was stifled at that point. So they needed to move outward. And in the context of the San Luis Valley, this was the one area that especially the Taos colonies and the Rio Riba colonies were moving up north into the San Luis Valley. There were attempts since the 1830s, but nothing really happened until the 1850s. And a lot of this was post-Guadalupe Hidalgo and under American annexation. In the early 1850s, the first villages were established here in the San Luis Valley in the Rio Culebra Basin, and then on the Conejo side, which is on the opposite side, the west side of the San Luis Valley, just shortly after. The plazas raised, short season staple crops to survive at high elevations. And that included frijol bolitas, or the bolita beans, the avas, or the fava beans, the maíz blanco, or the white corn, which is the little short corn that was acclimated to this elevation, the cebolla, or the onions, the avaron, or the field peas, and the calabaza, or the pumpkin. women also gathered quilites, or the young lamb's quarters, vedrolagas, or purslane, piñon, champe, or rose hip, capulin, or chokecherry, and galamburio, or gooseberry. Okay, I'd like to talk a little bit about litigation as a consequence of American land tenure. So I'm going to just kind of move over here. So these are going to be, you're going to have to edit this.
Yeah,
because it's all. Okay.
And you have answered, that was the first three questions.
Did I take a lot of your?
No. Okay. It's good. I'm just trying to, because I know you'd said that you wanted to combine things.
Yeah, so I kind of, hopefully I combine some stuff. What I would like to do is talk about the commercialization of agriculture and how that relates to the introduction of the railroad. The railroad on the San Ysidro land grant was the marking point of radical changes in the whole San Luis Valley. In order for the railroad to come in to the San Luis Valley, the owner of the land grant, who was the first territorial governor of Colorado, William Gilpin, offered the Denver Rio Grand Railroad, Denver and Rio Grand Railroad, the DNRG, a third of the land grant. They were here in the valley between 1878-1879 is when the railroad finally reached into the San Luis Valley. The DNRG's engine and boxcars traveled along a 3-foot narrow gauge rail. You'll fix this up, okay. Initially, freight, not passengers, were the primary interest of the rail promoters. The Denver Railroad's investors had a three-pronged strategy. Foremost, they wanted to monopolize transportation of minerals from the San Luis Valley. They wanted to reroute merchandise and trade from the Santa Fe Trail, and they intended to dominate all freight into the area. With the entry of the railroad into the valley, products reached the Front Range for routing north to Wyoming and east to Kansas City and Chicago. And locally, the railroad transported $500,000 worth of supplies from the San Luis Valley to mining sites in the San Juan. So the railroad was a radical departure from this upland areas that was, people talk about pristine, but definitely the San Luis Valley prior to the introduction of the railroad was relatively pristine. After the arrival of the railroad, Costilla County, which is one of the first 17 counties in the state of Colorado, became an underdeveloped peripheral colony. It was always subservient to the needs of the Front Range, and the Front Range is like from Colorado Springs, Denver, up to Fort Collins. As the value of land increased, the pobladores could not, and pobladores is another word of saying settlers, could never pay, had problems paying their property taxes, and they were also under pressure to be removed from the land by land companies that dominated the San Luis Valley. When the San Luis Valley had two land grants, the San Luis Cristo, which is at a million acres, which was at the eastern end of the valley, and at the western end was the Conejos land grant. The San Luis Cristo was unique in the context of the San Luis Valley because it was owned by one private owner, Carlos Buvian, who owned a million acres. The Conejos land grant was a polar opposite, and it was a communal land grant, although research kind of shows that eventually it became privatized, but initially it was a communal land grant. Of all the land grants in Colorado, and there were about six of them, the Conejos was the only communal land grant. So basically, we had in Costilla County land companies that were the successor entitled to the land from the original owner, which was Carlos Buvian, and they ended up owning the land through William Gilpin, purchased it in 1864. And after that, a series of land companies controlled the land. And because of that problem, because it was all privatized, the pobladores, or the settlers, were always in a cycle of credit, debt, and litigation. and they had a very difficult time competing with the Midwest Argonauts and the European immigrants who applied their business savvy to livestock raising and agricultural production. But before the arrival of the railroad, the cash economy was minimal. People were always bartering. There was a limited amount of cash around. So people used their produce to subsist. A lot of this changed with the arrival of an immigrant. There were a lot of German immigrants that came into the Santa de Cristo land grant. And they were not only their big kind of claim to not kind of but their big claim to fame of the German immigrants is that they were merchants. They were very savvy. They were also plugged into at that time into the Santa Fe trade. They encouraged a lot of monocropping. And so I kind of would like to talk just a little bit of monocropping and how monocropping was started early on in the Taos County, and then that moved into the San Luis Valley. In the 1880s and 1890s, there was monocropping of wheat in the Taos Valley. And basically the wheat that was monocropped in the Taos area went to the gold mines in Colorado, into the Denver area. By 1887, the granaries were filled to capacity in Taos County with wheat. In the San Luis area, kind of moving back in time, basically, you know, originally the Puebladores used handmills or metates and manos to grind what they called old Taos corn, which was the mainstay of the community. You know, and there was an eyewitness account in 1859 that described what this these old mills, community mills, were like. It was this is from Albert Richardson, who came here in 1859, and he described the mill. He says, "Nearby was a Mexican grist mill. It was simply a horizontal water wheel with a millstone one story above the stone, revolving no faster than the wheel. Grinds slowly and having no bolting apparatus, turns out very coarse flour." There were mills, and the original communal mills were on the streams in all of the San Luis Valley, and they were the same way in Taos. All of these customs were brought from Taos, and this was the norm in New Mexico prior to American occupation, as they had these what they're calling a Mexican grist mill. During American occupation, this all changed, and the one factor that encouraged monocropping besides the gold rush was the military, and the military had needs for large quantities of wheat. Basically, our Santa de Cristo land grant, one of the early acquisitions of land was for a flour mill, and it was run all on water power, amazingly. Carlos Bouvian, who was the owner of the land grant, designated a site for a flour mill, and in 1863, he deeded the mill site to Saran St. Vrain. And St. Vrain was the key to the success of the San Luis Mill because he was a flour contractor for the military. And you should know that the most northern fort in the American West was at Fort Garland, which is on the Santa de Cristo land grant. And it's probably about 30 miles from the New Mexico border. St. Vrain not only supplied, again, he did not only supply the military here in Colorado, he also did it in New Mexico. And he also took he was the earliest supplier of foodstuffs to the Denver mining camps. Through his partnership with Harvey St. Vrain, Harvey Easterday, St. Vrain constructed the first modern mill in the San Luis Valley. Although the Puebladores had harvested wheat with a sickle and hand rake, St. Vrain modernized the processing and commercialized wheat production when he imported the modern mill from St. Louis. So they brought that in by oxen, a modern steel mill from St. Louis. He also advertised for a millwright who could set up a modern cleaning and bolting machinery. And this is in 1859. Again, in 1859, late in the year, St. Vrain took a 26 oxen driven wagon loads with a thousand sacks of wheat to the Denver gold fields. In 1860, Saint Vrain delivered another 1,000 pounds of flour to Auraria. Eventually, the flour mill from San Luis supplied mining camps in Golden, California, Gulch Canyon City, and this called the Rocky Mountain News to proclaim that the San Luis mill ability to provide American milled flour to miners in the mining district. With commercial processing, once they started processing wheat at the commercial level, San Luis matured into a regional center. Although most families raised, you know, the basic staples that I already described, you know, beans and peas and potatoes at subsistence levels, St. Vrain's mills encouraged monocropping. He not only delivered wheat here north in Colorado, he was also the contractor for forts north of all the forts north of El Paso, Texas. And some of the larger ranchers overplanted of wheat. For example, St. Vrain received premium prices for flour delivered at Fort Garland, surpassing traditional corn production. So when wheat started going up, the locals stopped processing corn, traditional Taos corn, and they started turning to wheat. The shift from growing subsistence crop to marketing surpluses was evident in an 1870 agricultural survey that I found. The survey was really difficult to read. I had to do it with a magnifying glass. But basically, this census looked at 157 farms, which raised over 5,000 acres of wheat, although there was some corn and oats and barley. The majority was in wheat. Although there were some oats, and that was another thing that was encouraged besides wheat was oats, because the army had all of the horses and they needed the oats. And so that was the second thing. So definitely the army was driving monocropping, and so were the gold miners. So those were two kind of important issues that commercialized agriculture and took it out from this barter subsistence level, although very few profited. The majority still remain subsistence farmers. And even though there was an economic boom, the majority of the Puebladores were considered small-scale producers. And very few locals owned any large ranches of significance. It was totally different. The Rio Abajo in southern New Mexico was really characterized by having large kind of estates and ranches. But up north, they were never could compare with the kind of production that was existent in this time in the Rio Abajo. The monocropping of wheat continued, and I found a really interesting piece, and it was a WPA interview in the New Mexico archives, and it was in the Taos Valley, and this story related into the 1880s and 1890s, when monocropping of wheat in the Taos Valley was at its peak. And as I mentioned, in 1887, the granaries were filled to capacity in Taos County. Well, according to this one interview, there was a gang of raiders that were looking at wheat, and they went into this granary and they hijacked the wheat and stole it, because they were going to go take it to Denver and sell it, but they ended up getting caught. But that just showed that as a commodity, what wheat was able to do at that time period, you know, it disrupted the fabric of the community. Not that people never stole, but at this level, this was a major hijacking of a whole granary in Taos County. In the San Luis Valley, monocropping of wheat continued, especially in the northern part of the San Luis Valley. For example, in 1884, this person named T.C. Henry had about 10,000 acres of wheat. He cleared the land for these 10,000 acres by dragging a railroad tie across the ground and burning all the chico. And when you burn the ground, you ruin the soil. He also sub-irrigated. He created all these trenches to raise the water table. He had seven flour mills throughout the valley. But because of the bad water practices, which is infusing the subsurface water with trenches with water, he brought out the soils. They also did not rotate their crops, and the soils were depleted, and a lot of the farmland was abandoned by 1894. So monocropping is really difficult on the land. And prior to the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, there was never really monocropping. But post-Guadalupe Hidalgo, there was monocropping, and it was disastrous to the soils and to communities. Okay.
And is any of it still left?